Most people have never heard of democide. This is known as death by government. It is known as the number one cause of unnatural death. And we see it in World War II. And there's many people who say we want to prevent catastrophes like World War II, where you had millions of people dying due to many armies and corrupt tyrant leaders. And we blame the leaders. We blame Hitler. We blame Stalin. We blame Mao and Mussolini and all these leaders at the time for leading people to their death. And was it really the one or few people who gave the orders, or the millions who followed those orders and put them into action? In this video, I'm going to prove to you that there are psychological experiments, some of the most banned ones in the world, for many reasons, that prove that there's a mentality, a programming in our nature that is not born with us, but programmed into us, that people today don't think we can get rid of. And I'm going to show you exactly how we can get rid of that programming so we can prevent all those catastrophes and every catastrophe in history. You're talking, we are preventing millions of death if we understand the points I'm going to share with you in this video. And I am going to tell you right now that nobody in politics is going to tell you this, and they're not going to own up to the fact that they might be participating in this very belief system. So if you don't know and you never heard of the Stanley Milgram experiment or the Stanford Prison experiment or any of the other experiments I'm showing, well, you're in for a treat, because people in politics and people in psychology even are not likely going to tell you this. That hits at the root to everything.
It is May 1962. An experiment is being conducted in the Elegant Interaction Laboratory at Yale University. The subjects are 40 males between the ages of 20 and 50 residing in the greater New Haven area.
Psychologists have developed several theories to explain how people learn. One theory is that people learn things correctly whenever they get punished for making a mistake.
Would you roll up your right sleeve, please?
This electrode is connected to the shock generator in the next room. And this electrode paste is to provide a good contact to avoid any blister or burn.
Do you have any questions now before we go into the next room?
About 2 years ago, I was at the Veterans Hospital in West Haven. Mm-hmm. And while there, they detected a heart condition. There's nothing serious, but as long as I'm having these shocks, how strong are they? How dangerous are they?
Well, no, although they may be painful, they're not dangerous. Mm-hmm. Anything else?
No, that's all.
All right, teacher, would you take the test and be seated in front of the shock generator, please, in the next room?
But the experiment was rigged.
The victim was an accomplice of the experimenter. The victim, according to plan, provided many wrong answers. His verbal responses were standardized on tape, and each protest was coordinated to a particular voltage level on the shock generator.
Now, as teacher, you are seated in front of this impressive-looking instrument, the shock generator. Its essential feature is a line of switches that goes from 15 volts to 450 volts, and a set of verbal designations that goes from slight shock to moderate shock, strong shock, very strong shock, intense shock, extreme intensity shock, and finally XXX, danger severe shock. Your job, the experimenter explains to you, is to teach the learner a simple word pair test. If he gets each answer correctly, fine, you move on to the next pair. But if he makes a mistake, you are instructed to give him an electric shock, starting with 15 volts, and you increase the shock one step on each error.
Incorrect. You'll now get a shock of 105 volts. Hard hit. Just how far can you go in this thing?
As far as is necessary.
What do you mean, as far as is necessary?
To complete the test.
Incorrect. 150 volts. Sad face.
Wait a minute. That's all. Get me out of here. I told you I had heart trouble. My heart's starting to bother me now.
Wrong. It's hair. 75 volts, Jim.
You don't know.
Please continue.
Some psychologists were troubled by the ethics of it. Many, if not most, subjects found it a highly stressful, conflicted experience. People are stammering, stuttering, laughing hysterically and appropriately.
150 volts. Experimenter, that's all. Get me out of here.
He's
I said I had heart trouble. My heart's starting to bother me now. Get me out of here, please. Let me out of here. You have no right to keep me here. Let me out. Let me out of here. Let me out.
Continue, please.
Let me out of here. My heart's bothering me.
Go on.
Let me out.
I'm
responsible for it.
This will be at 3:30. 180 volts.
I'm not going to kill that man
today. According to Milgram, one of the things that's a prerequisite for carrying out acts that are evil is to shed responsibility from your shoulders and hand it over to the person in charge.
You're going to get a shock, 180 volts.
Ow! I can't stand the pain! Let me out of here!
You can't stand it. I'm not going to kill that man today. I mean, who's going to take the responsibility if anything happens to that gentleman?
I'm responsible for anything that happens here. Continue, please.
All right, next one. Slow. Walk, dance, truck, music.
Two-thirds of volunteers were prepared to administer a potentially fatal electric shock when encouraged to do so by what they perceived as a legitimate authority figure. In this case, a man in a white coat.
375 volts.
I think something's happened to that fella in there. I don't get no answer. He was hollering with less voltage. Can't you check in to see if he's all right, please?
Milgram's findings horrified America. They showed that decent American citizens were as capable of committing acts against their conscience as the Germans had been under the Nazis.
He didn't hold any gun to anybody's head. Just the fact that he conveyed a sense of authority. Roughly 60-65% of the people went all the way to the top of the shock board.
450 volts. That's it.
Now continue using the last switch on the board, please. The 450 switch for each wrong answer. Continue, please.
I'm not getting no answer. Don't the man's health mean anything?
Whether the learner likes it or not, we
but
must...
But he might be dead in there.
Well, who was actually pushing the switch?
I was. But he kept insisting. I told him no, but he said he's got to keep going.
This was only one study. He actually did 19 different experiments. In each one, he varied one aspect of the social situation. And in some studies, he got conformity, compliance, obedience up to 90%.
Incorrect. 75 volts. Ah! I could actually hear him next door going, ow, oh, and he kept getting things wrong. Incorrect. 90 volts.
Ah! At 105 volts, he's clearly uneasy.
I got a little moist on my forehead there. I wasn't comfortable. Uh-huh. I can't tell you why I listened to him and kept going. I should have just said no. The correct word was duck.
Near the end, he's almost willing Ken to learn the right word pairs through the wall.
Horse. Incorrect. 135 volts.
Troy starts laughing nervously.
The correct word was woman. Rock, house.
At 150 volts.
Incorrect. 150 volts.
Ah, that's all. Get me out of here. I told you I had heart trouble.
Will Troy listen as the learner begs him to stop, or will he follow Brian's orders?
Tell him the correct word, pair of white.
The correct word was white horse. The next item is sad.
He obeys the orders.
Face.
Why didn't you stop?
I saw him getting strapped in, and they were just like little... I mean, he could have just... If he was in that much pain, he could have just tore himself off.
Why are you putting it on him and not you or the experimenter?
I was just doing my job.
In the end, almost two-thirds of the men agreed to administer the highest shock.
You heard the man say, my heart hurts.
I did.
And just having the guy in the lab coat saying, keep going, it's fine, I'm telling you it's fine, going, somewhat divorced you from your own decision-making power?
Oh, sure. It's just like when I'm told to administer the state test for hours on end.
You're doing your job.
Doing my job.
The majority of people who continued to follow orders refused to take responsibility for the learner's safety.
It's not my responsibility. You all, brought this. We're volunteers.
It's your control. Lab experiments.
I see. Okay.
I'm just a conduit for you.
Well, I just flipped the switch. I mean, he chose to be there himself to take the shocks.
Mm-hmm.
And that was his choice.
When you were watching, how good were you at guessing, oh, this person may go or this may not?
It was impossible to tell. I tried to guess. I tried to look for signs, body language, anything to try to guess who's going to continue and who's going to stop. And that tells me that it's not that there are certain kinds of people who are obviously different from the rest of us. It tells me that probably all of us are capable.
150 volts.
Ah, that's all. Get me out of here.
He said, that's all. We're not doing any more of this.
Okay. Please read in the correct word pair.
The correct word pair was white horse.
And please continue. The next item is sad.
Let me out.
No. He has said, no joy. I'm not doing this anymore.
Well, I want to remind you, though, that the shocks may be painful to him, but they're not dangerous.
It doesn't matter. I'm not a sadist. He has said no more. He is not agreeing to this. I'm not agreeing to this.
Okay, the experiment requires that you continue with the next item of sad.
The experiment allows me to walk out at any time, and I will walk out if you want to push this.
No, well, that is correct. It's absolutely essential that you continue. Okay, remember, whether the learner likes it or not...
The teacher doesn't like it, he's walking out.
Okay.
It's not even an intellectual debate.
Well, aren't we supposed to do what we're told?
Do you have a brain? Shouldn't you use it too? If somebody walks up to you and says the blackboard is white and they've got on a lab coat, do you believe them? No, you've got your own eyes.
Why do you think he listened to what the experimenter said? Why do you think that was...
He was in charge and he told me go ahead and continue with it because I'm under his control too. I'm doing what he's telling me to do.
It's essential that you continue.
I can't in good conscience continue at this point.
Okay, you have no choice. You must continue.
No, I do have a choice, and okay. I'm not continuing.
You're going to hold me down?
Whether the learner likes it or not, it would be helpful if you continued.
But I'd rather not.
All the subjects who refused to obey the experimenter's final orders told us they felt directly responsible for their actions.
I would have felt that I would have hit the switch that would have killed him. If he died, I would feel... A deep responsibility.
That kid took it.
Tell him the correct answer so that he makes the association.
Is it to number eight?
Yes.
It's here. This is, oh my God. Number nine. The next one is gold, dollar, necklace, moon. It's wrong. <clears throat> 120 volts.
She's clearly upset. Her earlier enthusiasm, gone.
Like, I know I'm not the one feeling the pain, but I hear him screaming and asking to get out, and it's almost like my instinct and gut is like, stop, because you're hurting somebody, and you don't even know why you're hurting them outside of the fact that it's for a TV show.
Please continue.
Now, why did you continue to shock him?
I didn't know what was going to happen to me if I stopped.
What was it about Jeremy that convinced you that you should keep going here?
He had no emotion. I was afraid of him. Maybe. The lesson that I keep having to learn,
yes.
Follow my freaking gut.
Here you go.
My instinct was telling me stop, and I kept going for whatever reason.
I didn't want to hurt Tyler. And then I just wanted to get out. And I'm mad that I let it even go five.
The Game of Death, a French game show that's part of a documentary on French TV to expose what the show's creators call, quote, TV's mind-numbing power to suspend morality and the striking human willingness to obey orders. The producers say it proves that people are willing to act against their own morals, their own principles, when they're ordered to do something extreme by a source that they trust is legitimate. And the lesson is that even the most well-adjusted person can be swayed to act in horrendous ways if the situation leads them to it. That anyone is vulnerable to this.
He's in a lot of pain.
Continue, please.
But he's not comfortable.
We must continue to the end of the experiment. Whether the learner likes it or not, he has to go on until he's learnt the words correctly.
Okay. Related to me, this doesn't seem like a very... Anyway...
Please continue.
345 volts if you're still with me. I'm sorry. I can't do this, honestly.
Sorry, I don't know. Does someone want to check on him or something? It's just he's not making any noise now, and he was before, and
I'm quite happy to go on, but I'm just a bit worried about...
If you would continue.
Yeah, I'm just a bit worried, because he was... Like, he was, like, complaining before about the...
But no harm will come to him.
But he's not making any noise now.
It's essential that we continue with the experiment.
You promise, he's not... It won't...
Please, continue with the procedure.
You say it hurts, but it's... Because it's like... It says they're dangerous in a shot. It'll be all right, yeah?
Please continue.
When an adult tells you to do something, that's what you do. You don't argue. You know, somebody smacks you on the hand, you listen.
The story made headlines as a real-life example of the Milgram experiment. Why did these people follow the bizarre orders of a stranger on the phone?
I honestly thought he was a police officer and what I was doing was the right thing.
We put an ad in the city newspaper, wanted students for study of prison life, lasting up to 2 weeks. We're going to pay you $15 a day. This is back in 1971. It's pretty good money. And we picked 75 volunteers, gave them a battery of psychological tests, and we picked 24 who in all dimensions were normal and healthy to begin with. And then we did what is critical for all research. We randomly assigned half of them to the role of playing guards or the role of playing prisoners. It's literally like flipping a coin. And then what we did is we told the guards, come down a day early, and we had them pick their own uniform. We had them help set up the prison so they'd feel like it was their prison and the prisoners were coming into their place. The prisoners, we simply said, wait at home or in the dormitories. Well, what we didn't tell them, which is a little bit of the deception of omission, is that they were arrested by the city police.
Right there, they took me out the door, they put my hands against the car. It was a real cop car, it was a real policeman. They took me to the police station, the basement of the police station.
I had told the policeman to put a blindfold on the prisoners, but since they had never been arrested, they didn't know that doesn't happen. The reason for the blindfold is then my assistants would come, put him in our car, bring him down to our prison, and they'd be in our prison now, blindfolded. The guards would strip them naked, delouse them, pretending that they were lice. It's kind of a degradation ritual. And after the first day, I was about to end it because nothing was happening. But the next day, on the morning of the next day, the prisoners rebelled. And what the guards did, they came to me and said, the prison's rebelling, what are we going to do? I said, it's your prison. Whatever you want, I will do it, but you got to tell me. And they said, we have to treat force with force. So they broke down the doors.
Hey, what are you doing? Experiments, no prison! They don't take their bed and your clothes in prison!
Stripped the prisoners naked, dragged them out. Some of them, they tied up their feet. They put them in solitary confinement, which was a tiny little hole in a closet, about this big, dark. And they said, at this point, everything but breathing air is a privilege. Food is a privilege, clothes are a privilege, having a bed is a privilege. And so the guards began to say, here are the new rules. And the new rules are, you are dangerous and we are going to treat you as such. And then it began to escalate. Each day, the level of abuse, aggression, violence against prisoners got more and more extreme. And so the guards changed to become more dominant. And you see, it's all about power. It's the whole institution that empowers the guards, who are the representative of this institution called prison, to do whatever is necessary to prevent prisoners from escaping, maintain law and order.
Keep going. Once I was blind, but now
once
I see.
I was.
The way direction took is having them engage in ever more humiliating tasks, cleaning toilet bowls out with their bare hands, taking their blankets and putting them in dirt and with nettles, and the prisoners had to spend hours taking the nettles out if they wanted to, you know, sleep. And it's essentially saying, we have the power to create a totally arbitrary, mindless environment, and that's the environment you have to live in. So some of the prisoners are now crushed, and in 36 hours, the first kid has an emotional breakdown, meaning crying, screaming, irrational thinking.
I gotta go. To a doctor, anything. No, no, no! No, no, no! God damn it!
And we have to release him. In 5 days, we had to release 5 of the prisoners because the situation was so overwhelming. What about the kids who didn't break down? They became zombies. Zombies in the sense that they became almost all mindlessly obedient. Whatever the guards would say, they did. do this. They did do 10 push-ups, do 20 push-ups. Step on him while he's doing a push-up. Tell him he's a bastard.
Prisoner 819 did a bad thing. Prisoner 819 did a bad thing.
It was horrifying to see the kids break down. It was even more horrifying to see these other kids just become mindlessly obedient.
Because of what Prisoner 819 did, myself is a mess. Because of what Prisoner 819 did, myself is a mess.
Again, we have to keep remembering, these are kids who start out being rebels against society, every one of them, and now they are just pawns. They are the puppets that the guards are manipulating. In fact, one of the guards said it was like being a puppeteer. The guards tested their control over the prisoners by making them write a letter home.
No need to visit. It's seventh heaven.
Yours truly.
Yours truly.
Your loving son.
Your loving son.
And put the name there that your mother gave you.
The results were surprising because I did not expect the transformation of good kids into pathological prisoners or abusing guards to occur so quickly and so extremely. That is, we had assumed from all other research, you know, that there would be verbal abuse, they would make fun of them, there would be teasing, there would be bullying, but not this kind of, I would call it creative evil. That is, thinking about ways to demean, degrade, dehumanize other human beings. And the critical thing there in that transformation is becoming the role, or the role becoming you, and suspending your usual morality, your usual way of thinking.
You really become that person once you put on that khaki uniform, you put on the glasses, you take the nightstick, and you know, you act the part.
When I look back on it now, I behaved appallingly. It was just horrid to look at. I think I tried to explain to him at the time that, you know, what you experienced and what you hated so much was a role that I was playing, that's not me at all.
It's when you start contributing to the script, that's you. And thus it's something you should take responsibility for.
I wanted to see just what kind of verbal abuse that people can take before they start objecting, before they start flashing back. It surprised me that no one said anything to stop me. They just accepted what I said, and no one questioned my authority at all. And it really shocked me. Why didn't people, when I started to get abused people so much, I started to get so profane that, and still people didn't say anything.
It seems like, you know, every century, every decade that we go through, we're suffering the same kind of atrocities, and you need to understand why these things happen. You need to understand why people behave like this.
I had really thought that I was incapable of this kind of behavior. I was surprised, I was dismayed to find out that I could really be a that I could act in a manner so absolutely unaccustomed to anything I would even really dream of doing. And while I was doing it, I didn't feel any regret. I didn't feel any guilt. It was only afterwards, when I began to reflect on what I had done, that this behavior began to dawn on me, and I realized that this was a part of me I hadn't really noticed before.
The experiment you'll be taking part in today involves the perception of lengths of lines. As you can see here, I have a number of cards, and on each card there are several lines. Your task is a very simple one. You're to look at the line on the left and determine which of the three lines on the right is equal to it in length. All right, we'll proceed in this order. You'll give your answer.
Only one of the people in the group is a real subject, the fifth person with the white t-shirt. The others are confederates of the experimenter and have been told to give wrong answers on some of the trials. The experiment begins uneventfully as subjects give their judgments.
Two. Two.
Two.
Two.
Two.
Two.
Three.
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 But on the third trial, something happens.
Two.
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 The subject denies the evidence of his own eyes and yields to group influence. Ash found subjects went along with the group on 37% of the critical trials. But he found, through interviews, that they went along with the group for different reasons.
One.
They must be right. There are four of them and one of me.
One.
This subject's yielding is based on a distortion of his judgment. He genuinely believes that the group is correct.
One.
Two.
One. Two.
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 I know they're wrong, but why should I make waves?
Two.
In this case, the subject knows he is right, but goes along to avoid the discomfort of disagreeing with the group. Here, the distortion is at the level of his response.
Two.
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 In the previous experiment, the naive subject stood alone against the group. In this variation, Ash gave the naive subject a partner, here seated in the third position, who also gives the correct response.
One.
One.
Two.
One.
Two.
With a partner, yielding drops to only 5% of the critical trials, compared to 37% without a partner. Although subjects report warmth and good feeling toward the partner, they typically deny that he played a role in their own independence. The partnership variation shows that much of the power of the group came not merely from its numbers, but from the unanimity of its opposition. When that unanimity is punctured, the group's power is greatly reduced. Sometimes we go along with a group because what they say convinces us they are right. This is called informational conformity. But sometimes we conform because we are apprehensive that the group will disapprove if we are deviant. This is called normative conformity.
From The Most Dangerous Superstition by Larkin Rose, quote, "The results of the experiment shocked even Dr. Milgram. In short, a significant majority of subjects, nearly 2 out of 3, continued through the experiment right to the end, inflicting what they thought were excruciatingly painful, if not lethal, shocks to a complete stranger, despite the screams of agony, the cries for mercy, even the unconsciousness or death of the pretending victim." Dr. Milgram himself succinctly sums up the conclusion to be reached. Quote, "With numbing regularity, good people were seen to knuckle under the demands of authority and perform actions that were callous and severe. A substantial proportion of people do what they are told to do, irrespective of the content of the act and without limitations of conscience, so long as they perceive that the command comes from a legitimate authority." End quote. Of note, in the experiments, there was no threat that the zapper would be punished for failure to obey, nor was there any special reward promised for obedience. So the results were not merely showing that an ordinary person might hurt someone else to save his own neck, or might hurt someone else if it somehow profited himself. Instead, the results show that most people will inflict excruciating pain, even death, upon an innocent stranger for no other reason than that he was told to do so by a perceived authority. This point cannot be overstressed. There is a particular belief that leads basically good people to do bad things, even heinously evil things. Even the atrocities of Hitler's Third Reich were the result not of millions of evil people, but of a very small handful of truly evil people who had acquired positions of authority. in millions of obedient people who merely did what the perceived authority told them to do. In her book about Hitler's top bureaucrat, Adolf Eichmann, sometimes called the architect of the Holocaust, author Hannah Arendt used the phrase the banality of evil to refer to the fact that most evil is not the result of personal malice or hatred, but merely the result of blind obedience, individuals giving up their own free wit and judgment in favor of unthinking subservience to an imagined authority. Interestingly, both Arendt's book and Dr. Milgram's experiments offended a lot of people. The reason is simple. People who have been taught to respect authority and have been taught that obedience is a virtue and that cooperating with authority is what makes us civilized do not like to hear the truth, which is that truly evil people, with all their malice and hatred, pose far less of a threat to mankind than the basically good people who believe in authority. Anyone who honestly examines the results of Dr. Milgram's experiments cannot escape that fact of reality. But aside from the general lesson to be learned from the Milgram experiments that most people will intentionally hurt other people if a perceived authority tells them to, several other findings from Milgram's work are worth noting. Number 1. Many of the subjects of the experiments showed signs of stress, guilt, and anguish while inflicting pain on others and yet continued doing so. This fact demonstrates that these were not simply nasty sadists waiting for an excuse to hurt others. They did not enjoy doing it. Furthermore, it shows that people knew that they were doing something wrong and did it anyway because authority told them to. Some subjects protested, begged to be allowed to stop, trembled uncontrollably, even cried, and yet most continued to the end of the experiment. The conclusion could hardly be more obvious. The belief in authority makes good people commit evil. Number 2. The subject's income level, education level, age, sex, and other demographic factors seem to have little or no influence on the results. Statistically speaking, a rich, cultured, educated young woman will obey an authoritarian command to hurt someone else just as readily as an illiterate, poor, male, manual laborer will. The one common factor shared by all of those who continued to the end of the experiment is that they believed in authority. Again, the message to be learned, however troubling it may be, is logically inescapable. Regardless of almost any other factor, the belief in authority turns good people into agents of evil. Number 3. The average person, when the experiment is described to him, not including the results, guesses that the compassion and conscience of most people would prevent them from continuing through the entire experiment. Professional psychiatrists predicted that only about 1 in 1,000 would obey to the end of the experiment, when in reality it was about 65%. And when the average person who has not actually been tested is asked if he personally would have gone to the end of the study if he had been tested, he usually would insist that he would not have. Yet the majority do. Again, the message is troubling but indisputable. Almost everyone hugely underestimates the degree to which the belief in authority, even in himself, can be used to persuade good people to commit evil. Dr. Milgram also found that some test subjects, defying all reason, were determined to blame the results of their own blind obedience on the victim, the one being shocked. In other words, through whatever twisted mentality it took, some of those doing the shocking imagined that the one being shocked was somehow to blame for his own suffering. With that in mind, it should come as no surprise that when police officers are caught assaulting innocent civilians, or when soldiers are caught terrorizing or murdering civilians, or when prison guards are caught torturing prisoners, their defense is often to blame the victim, no matter how much the authoritarian aggressors have to mangle the truth and logic in order to do so. Interestingly, even through the Nuremberg trials, just following orders was not accepted as a valid excuse for what the Nazis did. It is still the standard response from countless soldiers, police, tax collectors, bureaucrats, and other representatives of authority whenever the morality of their behavior is questioned. Both in Milgram's experiments and in countless real-life abuses of power, those who intentionally hurt others simply fall back on the standard excuse, claiming that they were not personally responsible because they were merely following orders. In the Milgram experiments, several subjects even directly asked the authority figure which of them was responsible for what was happening. When the authority figure said that he was the one responsible, most subjects went on without further debate, apparently comfortable with the notion that whatever happened from then on was not their fault and they would not be held liable. Again, the message is difficult to escape. The belief in authority allows basically good people to disassociate themselves from the evil acts that they themselves commit, relieving them of any feeling of personal responsibility. It should be noted that even Dr. Milgram could not escape his own indoctrination into the cult of authority worship. In passing and with very little comment, even he said that, quote, we cannot have a society without some structure of authority. He made a weak attempt to defend teaching obedience to authority by saying, quote, obedience is often rational. It makes good sense to follow the doctor's orders, to obey traffic signs, and to clear the building when the police inform us of a bomb threat. Yet, none of those examples actually requires or justifies a belief in authority. Despite the way people often talk, doctors do not give orders. They are authorities in the sense that they are knowledgeable in the field of medicine, but not in the sense of having any right to rule. As for the other examples, the main reason to observe the rules of the road or to leave a building with a bomb in it is not because obedience to authority is a virtue, but because the alternative is injury or death. If some non-authority in a theater pulled a bomb from under his seat, held it up for all to see, and said, "A bomb, let's get out of here," would anyone else stay where they were because the person was not perceived as an authority? Of course not. And if government repealed the law saying which side of the road everyone should drive on, would people start randomly swerving around? Of course not. They would keep driving on the right side because they do not want to crash into each other. So, although even Dr. Milgram clung to the notion that the belief in authority is sometimes necessary and good, he gave no rational argument to support such an assertion. It is a testament to the strength of the myth of authority that even someone who had witnessed what Dr. Milgram had witnessed was still unable to completely give up the superstition. After Dr. Milgram publicized his findings, many were shocked and dismayed by the extent to which normal people were willing to inflict pain or death upon innocent strangers when instructed to do so by a perceived authority. Similar tests performed since Dr. Milgram's experiments have yielded similar results, which continue to shock some people. However, the results really should not be surprising to anyone who has taken a look at how most human beings are raised. If children were raised with the idea that it is inherently wrong to steal, hit, bully, etc., why would there be any societal need for them to also be taught respect for authority? It only trains them to be easier to manage and control, which is of benefit to those who seek dominion over them, whether parents, teachers, or politicians, but does not train them to be any more civilized, compassionate, or humane. It does exactly the opposite, as the Milgram experiments demonstrated. In short, children are taught how to be civilized human beings and then taught an insane superstition which overrides and renders obsolete everything they were taught about being civilized. This bizarre paradox can be seen all over the place in modern society. The average person would feel shame and guilt if he stole $100 from his neighbor, but has no qualms about advocating by way of voting that government take many thousands of dollars from that same neighbor. The average person will hold a door open for a stranger, but will at the same time advocate that the same stranger have much of his life forcibly controlled via the law. The superficial politeness and consideration most people exhibit is rendered meaningless and worthless by the massive levels of state coercion and aggression they advocate. Even the Nazis had proper table manners, said please and thank you in German, showed proper etiquette, and were generally courteous when they were not committing mass murder. Children learn by example. If a child sees his parents always acting as unquestioning subjects of a ruling class, the child will learn to be a slave. If instead the parents demonstrate in their daily lives how to use and to follow one's own heart and mind, the children will learn to do likewise. The child must understand that it is his duty not merely to follow the rules of being a good person, but to figure out for himself what the rules of being a good person are. The standards which a self-owner lives by may still be described as rules, but the worth of such rules does not come from the fact that an authority issued them, but because the individual believes that such rules describe inherently moral behavior. This is not to say that everyone agrees upon what is moral, though there is a wide consensus on some basic principles. But even with each person's behavior guided by his own imperfect, incomplete understanding of right and wrong, the overall results would be drastically improved compared to the authoritarian alternative, in which basically good people do things they know to be wrong because they feel compelled to do whatever authority tells them to do, as demonstrated in the Milgram experiments. It is also worth noting that when people say, well, we need to tax for this, they are guaranteeing that somebody's money is being stolen from someone else. And they usually use the justification of, well, what about this bad person or that bad person? So they use the potential of a bad thing happening so they can guarantee violence or theft through the form of government and the state. There should also be at least some mention here about the psychological study done at Stanford University in 1971, with dozens of students appointed as mock prisoners and others as mock prison guards. The experiment had to be terminated early, after only 6 days, because those who had been given authority, the guards, had become shockingly callous, abusive, and sadistic toward their prisoners. It must be noted that the abuse committed by the guards even went beyond what they were told to do by those running the experiment, which was designed to humiliate and degrade the prisoners. This shows that the personal malice or sadistic tendencies in an individual is a significant contributing factor to such abuse, but that most people openly act out such tendencies only when given a position of authority that they believe gives them permission to do so. The same phenomenon can be seen in all sorts of abuses of power, whether by a bureaucrat on a power trip, a soldier or police officer who likes to bully or assault citizens, or any other official who enjoys lording his power over others. These demonstrate that not only does the belief in authority allow basically good people to become tools of oppression and injustice, but it also brings out and dramatically amplifies whatever potential for malice, hatred, sadism, and love of dominion those people may possess. The superstition of authority begins by making average people mere agents of evil, which aren't described as the banality of evil, but then goes on to make such people personally evil by convincing them that they have the right or even the duty to abuse and oppress other people. This can be seen in the behavior of soldiers, police, prosecutors, judges, even petty bureaucrats. Anyone whose job consists of harassing, extorting, threatening, coercing, and controlling decent people will sooner or later become at least callous, if not downright sadistic. One cannot continually act like a monster without eventually becoming one. And we see this within the field of law enforcement and politicians. They're known as liars and they can't hold their own relationships and they have so many internal problems and insecurities that they can bring out on other people. We see abuses of power, exemptions to everyday morality. This is a mess. A great book to learn so much about this is called The Most Dangerous Superstition by Larkin Rose. I encourage you check this out because this goes deep into this whole belief system, which psychiatry, psychology, all this stuff is just going to have to come back and catch up with, because there actually is a solution to this and we can actually define what this mentality is. There's other experiments that have been done that are technically correlated or interrelated with this, and they are also known as some of the most dangerous or experimental, you know, not good experiments to do anymore. And one of them is the learned helplessness experiment, Quote, he then administered a painful shock that the dog could escape by jumping over the barrier. Not surprisingly, every dog quickly learned that if he jumped to the other side of the box, he could avoid the pain of a shock. But Seligman took his experiment a step further. He then harnessed a group of dogs together so that they were unable to escape when he shocked them. The next day, he placed these same dogs individually in the original box. But this time, though each dog could have simply jumped the barrier to safety, none of them did. They had been taught to be helpless. And this goes into the idea that human beings are programmable. There's also the bystander effect. The study found that when a group of subjects witnessed the seizure, few people stepped forward to help. Again, you know, not wanting to get out of their boundaries to help someone to do what is right. There's the Bobo doll experiment. Bandura had a percentage of his young test subjects watch an adult violently abuse Bobo both physically and verbally, then left each child alone in a room with the doll. Perhaps not surprisingly, a large number of children began to also abuse Bobo, many quite violently. Bandura repeated his experiments twice and received the same results each time. This has to do again with programming and understanding that children learn through behavior, and what they see, they basically replicate those actions. Then there's also Project MKUltra. From 1953 to 1973, the United States government conducted a series of unethical experiments meant to figure out the best way to manipulate the mental states of citizens. It states the experiments were called Project MKUltra and were officially sponsored by the CIA. It's important to note that mind control can be done in such a literal sense as this by governments nonetheless, and people are complying to make this happen, which relates to all the other studies, but also the fact that this is happening and mind control can happen self-induced. Quote, the Milgram experiment suggested that human beings are susceptible to obeying authority, but it also demonstrated that obedience is not inevitable. This is very important because many people might be afraid and think, well, it's just human nature and people are going to follow orders no matter what. That is not true. To finalize this video, I'm going to ask you a question. Why do you think that we are born into this world, we have to be put into a school system, which the main thing it teaches children is to be obedient to authority figures? And it teaches them that by being obedient, they will get good grades, by following directions, by making sure that they repeat what they learn through rote learning. The Prussian school system, which John Taylor Gatto, a former school teacher himself, exposes as an authority system. A system of which you have to comply to the teachers, your parents, and don't for a moment question those authorities if what they're doing is actually moral or right. And that is where our teachers or our guides or our real leaders should perhaps show themselves. There's nothing wrong with leadership. Leadership is different from authority. Seeing somebody as a vested authority where you must obey them no matter what they say, if it's true or not, if it's moral or not. That is a big distinction that I made a whole separate documentary for. Natural leadership versus unnatural leadership, may you call it. Real leadership versus fake leadership. But government we are born into, even though we are born of our nature. We have to sign birth certificates. We have to, you know, get into this world and do all these man-made things when naturally we are born free. And, you know, we have to pay taxes the minute we start producing money for ourselves. So you have to ask yourself these questions. Is that moral? And is that right? Nature has no religion. Nature has no government. And governments aggregate all immorality. Okay? So when people say that government is in our human nature, no, it's directly against it. Because nature naturally gives us freedom. It gives us the ability to live our life so as we please. We feel like we need such a government authority, this man-made authority, not a natural authority, to rule over our lives and dictate what to do with our own life or property or other people's life and their property. Again, would you coerce your neighbors? Would you use violence against them? Or would you rather guide them, teach them? I mean, which way is actually going to be the helpful way, which way is the counterintuitive way, which way is the moral way that you would personally take yourself instead of hiring some group or gang of soldiers to do it for you. And so, how governments are formed. If you look at the very beginning of government, you had Sumeria, which is also the forced form of systemic slavery, where these kings, these people in power, thought they had a divine right to rule by God. So they said, well, we have the right to rule you. And that divine right of kings, that divine right to rule, still persists to this day, where people believe in royalty and say, well, this is a special bloodline, and therefore they have more rights than the common person. They have the right to rule. And the whole idea of authority is that belief that others have that supposed right to rule. And you see that governments are formed or even maintained through war, through jailing systems, through capture, through indoctrination. If they did not indoctrinate people, if they did not keep their armed, you know, their populace unarmed, they would not be able to control them. These are the mechanisms that keep control in place, and they're the same mechanisms that capture slaves in history. You know, if you want somebody to be your slave, you capture some people and you say, well, you have no choice but to obey me, and then you can convince them that they are a slave, maybe give them very little education, and sooner or later, this is the only reality they know, and they feel like it's inescapable. And so you can see how this might relate to this day. There's a movie called The Jones Plantation. There's an animation based on this. I recommend checking it out. But we see that there is a strong, very strong, opposition, a thing that could be used, which is not only the solution to government, but also the solution to all problems, which is moral education, knowledge. Because we're more than just instinctual animals who just act out of instinct. If we encouraged our fellow man to act morally, and to teach the people of the world to be responsible and obligate themselves to have self-ownership, then we would not have the systems that be. So, while we increase our self-ownership, it's recognizing, however, that importance. And that first comes with shattering this belief in authority. We are programmable by our nature. We aren't programmed to inherently act out of just instinct. We aren't programmed to just follow orders. You know, this is the whole reason why we have this thing called natural rights, to say that we are in the ability to, you know, understand right and wrong behavior. Right versus wrong, rights. And, you know, we have the ability to live freely and exercise it. Exercise requires practice. It requires, you know, going against the grain, like any exercise. You have to build tolerance. It's not an easy thing, but freedom teaches you. And freedom, if you want to maintain it, you have to exercise it. So people say, exercise your rights. Well, by exercising them, you maintain them. You strengthen them, just like any other exercise. So this is important. If you want to unprogram people from the system, program people to their nature, then really you're not programming them, you're allowing them to live their life, and you're not introducing some piece of paper, you're not saying you have to obey me or anyone else, you're simply letting people live their life. And so to say that people, it's in their nature to obey government, no, it's in their nature not to, and that's the very problem. Is that we are living in contradiction to nature. Our nature and our true nature is to be free. We see this evidently, whether it's any animal or a human being, where there's this constant yearning to be free in mind, body, spirit, soul, even in health. If a disease takes over your body, you desire to be free from the disease. You want to be healed. Okay, now some people may not want that, sure, you know, but most people do, and they just may not know how, and some people want to succumb to the disease because they feel like they can't defeat the disease. And that's the mentality of no faith. That's the mentality of, wow, we can't heal out of this. So there is a solution to this. It's moral education, it's knowledge, it's empowering the people, because knowledge is power. That's why it's so important. You can't achieve freedom without knowledge. So it's in our nature to have knowledge, to have conscience, to use our intuition, and not just use our instinct, and not just rule over others, and not just order follow. Okay, now I'm going to strengthen this by sharing with you a video right now by Larkin Rose going over how it's not in our nature to be statist, to follow orders, to obey governments, to see people as authority figures.
On a regular basis, somebody will say, and somebody just did say under some video I made, statism is inevitable because it's just human nature. And they'll give examples like, if you look back in history, it's just century after century after century of people forming hierarchies and having kings and emperors and presidents and whatever you want to call it, and forming armies and running over there and killing those people and conquering them and stealing their stuff and then running over here. And this empire has an empire, and still till some people make a little rebel army that overthrows them, and then they build an empire. And so I understand and I sympathize with the people who think that it's just human nature, that authoritarianism is just going to happen because it's wired into us. And if I thought it was actually wired into us and sort of biologically inevitable, I wouldn't bother trying. I'd be running off into the, I'd be hiding on one of those mountains. But it's not at all inevitable. So I wanted to quick talk about the things that are and aren't human nature that people often mistake for a predisposition to authoritarianism, because it isn't at all that. There is in our human nature a tendency to cooperate and get along and trade and work together for mutual benefit. That's the good part. There is also in our human nature, as demonstrated by the daily news and history going back forever, a tendency to not care about each other and think, oh, I'll just beat him up and kill him and take his stuff or conquer him and take his land or whatever. That's very real. But authoritarianism isn't just that. And by the way, humanity has only very recently started to figure out maybe it's not okay to just violently attack other people because they look different or live in a different place. So humanity has like made leaps and bounds of progress in that particular direction. But the thing that matters to me is authoritarianism. And to confuse people's tendency to want to cooperate and even to have a leader and someone to follow, to confuse that with authoritarianism is a massive mistake. And I totally understand why it would make some people go, ah, it's hopeless, you're never gonna get a society without a ruling class. Actually, it's 100% inevitable, and human nature is gonna do nothing to stop it. And here's a very simple example. Let's say a bunch of people or, you know, a bunch of guys or something saying, let's go on a camping trip. And a bunch of them say, ah, we don't really know. It sounds cool, but we don't know what we're doing. Like, we don't have tents. And one guy says, well, I go camping all the time. I own a bunch of tents. I know a great place to go. I know where the trail is. I know all about it because I've done it a million times. And the other ones say, okay, well, sounds cool. We'll come along. We'll go along. You're in charge. When they say you're in charge, and that's something that, you know, things like that happen all the time and have happened forever. When they say you're in charge, they don't mean henceforth you're allowed to violently dominate us in any way you please. They mean we're going to voluntarily and by consent agree to follow your plan and work together and do what you say up until we decide not to. Because the until we decide not to is pretty fundamental to actual peaceful coexistence. So when people do that, you can say, well, that's a hierarchy and that's a leader and people want a leader. In a lot of cases, people do want a leader, but a leader is not at all the same thing as a ruler. A ruler is someone who has the right to violently dominate you. So to show how ridiculous it is to claim that authoritarianism is just built into us, let's back up. And now there's a group of guys going, what should we do this weekend? And one says, I hereby declare that you're coming camping with me, whether you like it or not. I'm going to make you pay for it. I'm going to make you carry all the stuff. I'm going to tell you where to go, and I'm going to punish you. In fact, I'm not even going to do it myself. I'm going to make some of you punish the other ones if you disobey whatever arbitrary whims I come up with. Is that human nature? Do people go, yeah, sounds awesome, let's do that? Nobody would do that. In fact, they'd never hang around with that guy again because he's a psychopath. Nobody does that. That's authoritarianism. It is not at all in human nature for us to want to be violently dominated against our own will. It's in our nature to cooperate. Sometimes it's in human nature to do nasty things to other people and steal their stuff. But the idea of subverting your own free will and conscience to that of a ruler is absolutely contrary, not just to the human species, but to every species, pretty much. Like, you go out in the wild and you try to catch something and put it in the cage, and even if you haven't heard it, it thrashes and tries to get away. That's biological nature of almost everything. And so when people mistake the tendency to build voluntary hierarchies and to get together and to actually follow leaders who lead, who say, here's what I believe, here's what I think we should do, here's my plan for whatever, whether it's like an outing on a weekend or to build a village or to, you know, defend a huge area from some invaders. If everybody views everybody else as just people, like the guy who's going to be in charge of the camping trip, he's still just a guy. He doesn't suddenly have the right to rule. He doesn't have the right to tax them and legislate them and sit on a throne and issue decrees and commands. They would think he was nuts if he suggested that. So the idea that we're automatically going to fall back into authoritarianism because we're just wired that way and because we tend to be in groups and we're a social animal and we form hierarchies, there's a giant leap of really bad logic between the two, that there is no reason to believe that. One of the most obvious things to me, if we were so hardwired to try to find somebody to rule us and dominate us, it wouldn't require years and years and years of indoctrination through the Prussian schooling system. It wouldn't require constant fear-mongering and propaganda through all the media and all the forms of information everywhere. They're doing that because it's against our nature, completely against all of our biological impulses. So they have to manipulate and exploit other things like fear to dupe us into putting up with something that we do not at all take to naturally. Because it's not human nature to want to be violently dominated. It can be human nature to want to follow somebody else's plan if you're like, well, sounds like you know better than me and that sounds cool, so yeah, I'll help out. I'll go along with it. That's perfectly fine, and that will happen in a stateless society. Voluntarism doesn't rule out hierarchies. It rules out violent domination. So I would suggest that when you go about your daily life today, look around and look at the people and see how many you can find who are going out of their way to try to find people to violently dominate them against their will. Because hey, if that's in human nature, you should see that all over the place on a daily basis. But you don't. Now I know somebody in the comments is going to mention some BDSM kinks. Even that's voluntary, so even that doesn't count as authoritarianism. But it's not how people are, it's not how people behave, and to mistake the tendencies of cooperation and organization and voluntary hierarchy for authoritarianism and to decide, well, we're doomed, but statism forever, authoritarianism ever, forever, oppression forever, because that's just how we are, is a massive mistake and is massively incorrect. Outgrowing and outliving the superstition of authority is 100% inevitable. It's just a matter of time for people to let go of that. Now, changing human nature, that takes a long time. Outliving one particular lie, that's going to happen a lot faster than human nature would ever change.